Blog Talk Radio.
All right, taping for show to air Saturday, 10/26. Yeah. Anyway, taping to air Saturday, 10/26 for the balance. We're going to be calling Kent Sterling and Kevin Lee. First up, Kent Sterling. There'll be a 30-minute break after that where we'll contact Kevin Lee. This is not an official broadcast, so just to let you know that this is a taping, so this will be deleted. You could find it in the archives. Anyway, we're getting ready to do our taping.
Hi, this is Kent.
Hi, is this Kent?
Yes.
Hi, Kent. This is Tom Marquis, host of the Balance. How you doing?
Hi, Tom. I'm doing
good. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Yeah, okay. All right. Because we facilitate everything through Blog Talk, so I have to kind of tape through Skype back to Blog Talk and back to the board. So it's kind of got to make a loop there. So if there's a delay, I do apologize. Well, really, we're going to touch on a lot of things, if you don't mind. You seem to be knowledgeable of a lot of different sports. And certainly, we're going to talk about the World Series. We're going to talk about John Lester. Is he cheating, not cheating? Brett Favre. Maybe a little bit about the Pacers or Colts. Anything that you want to chime in on? Anything you want to add to that?
No, that sounds good.
All right. We'll just do the normal countdown, then we'll just go right in the interview. And
okay.
Certainly we'll probably start with the Brett Favre deal. Okay?
Okay.
All right. We'll do it. 3, 2, 1. Welcome back to The Balance. My name is Tom Marquis, El Presidente. I tell you what, it's an honor to have my next guest here with me on a Saturday morning. We had an opportunity to catch up with him earlier on in the week. And Kent Sterling from 1070 The Fan, WIBC here in Indianapolis, certainly no stranger to radio, and been in the Missouri market, St. Louis market, prior to coming back to Indianapolis. And those of you that live here in the Indianapolis market are very familiar with Kent Sterling. Kent, welcome to The Balance, your very first time here on The Balance. We appreciate you coming on board and taking some time with us today to talk with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Well, I tell you what, we got a lot to cover here, and I wanted to talk with you about a couple of things. A lot of the things that we're going to talk about, obviously, the St. Louis Cardinals and the World Series. St. Louis Cardinals being in the World Series against the Red Sox. You just came from working radio in the St. Louis market, so certainly you're very familiar with the teams and what's gone on there as well. So let's talk about this, the Brett Favre watch. I tell you what, I thought Twitter was going to shut down this week. Brett Favre, possibly, could it be? Oh no, on the edge of our seats, could Brett Favre be coming back to the NFL and playing for the St. Louis Rams? Of course, all hogwash, but what were your thoughts when you first heard that?
My first thought was that Kevin Demoff is a genius for making the St. Louis Rams nationally relevant. There's no other road to relevance for the Rams. Grabbing the Favre straw, I thought was a stroke of genius.
So let me ask you this. Do you think that was kind of a deliberate plant just to get people talking about the St. Louis Rams again?
It wouldn't surprise me. Kevin Demoff's the COO of the Rams, and he's got a great sense of humor. He enjoys toying with the media from time to time. He's really a very honest guy and a great guy to deal with. But I think that he was having a little bit of fun, and he and Les Snead and Jeff Fisher, I thought that they were just enjoying themselves a little bit.
Perhaps he's taking a page out of Jim Irsay's how to tweet to the media book. absolutely. Well, obviously, that's not where the Rams decided to end up with. They ended up with Brady Quinn. Still got themselves a first-round draft pick. It's probably the only way that's going to happen. Well, my thoughts are, and maybe I'm the only guy out there that still believes that Tim Tebow could be – now, could he be a Brett Favre? No. Could he be an Andrew Luck or Peyton Manning? No. But could he be a good quarterback in – the NFL? I think so. Maybe I'm obsolete in that. I'm the only guy that thinks that. But why wouldn't the St. Louis Rams, being in the position that they were in after losing Bradford this past week to an injury, why wouldn't they look at Tim Tebow?
I think they all know what a lot of guys inside the league know. And that's that Tim Tebow was kind of uncovered. He was a guy who offensively brought some tools, and once people figured out what those tools were and how to scheme against it, then he became obsolete. And his reign of non-obsolescence, I think, lasted about 7 weeks. But everybody was able to scheme for him, and so now he's kind of a man without an outpost. And if anybody could have figured out a way to use Tim Tebow in a way to generate wins, I think it would have been Bill Belichick, who isn't a guy who's going to be fired because of a quarterback controversy. He's a guy who's strong with the media. He's a guy who, when he talks, people in New England listen. And that's really not so much the case in St. Louis. So you would activate an entire bunch of and this, I mean no disrespect toward anyone, but religious zealots who find Tim Tebow's story so compelling that they can't see beyond his inability to throw the ball accurately to understand that he just can't play in the NFL as it's constructed today.
Well, we're talking with Kent Sterling of 1070 The Fan, and obviously now it's the Sterling Report. Did I get that right? Is that your writing? Sterling.com. I'm KentSterling.com.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
KentSterling.com. Right.
And those of us are, well, maybe nationally as well, know Breakfast with Kent on your YouTube channel as well. Yeah, I know you have a lot of fun with that, and that's how I was able to connect with you. But certainly we look at the quarterback situation out there in the Rams, and really we look at the quarterback situation here in 2013. Is quarterbacks that scarce, or is it just getting harder and harder and harder to play quarterback in the NFL?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think it takes a very unique combination of qualities to be able to succeed at the quarterback position in the NFL. You have to be able to do a whole lot of things well or a couple of things exceptionally well. And nobody that the Rams currently have, they're not able to do that. Kellen Clemens is not an outstanding quarterback by any measure. And now the two guys they've brought in, Austin Davis and Brady Quinn, they're not either. I mean, really, you need – and nor was Sam Bradford. Sam Bradford has some gaping holes in his resume. Andrew Luck's a guy who absolutely does not. Andrew Luck for the Colts has the whole package. He's behaviorally perfect. He's physically stout. He's got a great arm. He's an excellent leader. The Colts have somehow wandered into the two best quarterbacks of these two eras, the Manning era, which is – you know, within a couple of years is coming to a close, and then I think his successor is going to be Andrew Luck.
Well, absolutely, and I tell you what, Andrew Luck, and I watch, and I'm not just saying this because I live here in Indianapolis and love the Colts, but I love the way that Andrew Luck handled the Denver Broncos. I think we really did see the future of our era, and exactly, the Indianapolis Colts managed to get Peyton Manning and Andrew Luck back-to-back. That is absolutely unheard of. We here in Indianapolis don't know what it's like to have a quarterback situation. I mean, we did there briefly, but really on a long-term basis, and that's something that the Rams have struggled with for a while, and we'll see how Quinn can do. Certainly, he's followed the same path, maybe he passed Tim Tebow, because he's played for outside of Cleveland. Tim Tebow's played for Denver and the Jets. And, of course, here recently, Brady Quinn was with the Kansas City Chiefs. So he's been with Cleveland. Brady Quinn's been with Cleveland, Denver, Kansas City, and the Jets. Does Brady Quinn finally find a home inside the St. Louis Rams?
No, no, he's not answered any question regarding his starting quarterback position with the Rams, nor is Kellen Clemens, nor is Austin Davis. They're all nice guys, or at least Davis and Clemens are. Brady Quinn, if he was a guy who could lead a team, he would have let him. If you look at him statistically, the games he's started, he's lost the vast majority of them. He's never had in any season in which he's played, he's never had a passer rating over 70. He's just really not very good.
Well, we're talking with Kent Sterling, 1070 The Fan, and Kent, I want to certainly jump into the World Series in the St. Louis Cardinals, my St. Louis Cardinals. You know what? I know in the media we're supposed to maintain a certain level of biasness, but when it comes to the Colts or the Cardinals, I kind of or IU basketball, I kind of throw that out the window. But I know you recently worked out there, WXOS, an ESPN affiliate out there, yeah, in St. Louis, very, very familiar with the Redbirds and the Cardinals and Mike Matheny and the St. Louis Cardinals. So you look at the trip that the Cardinals took, and they really didn't have an easy path getting to the World Series. And you look at one stumbling block that they had in the Pittsburgh Pirates. Who would have ever thought at the beginning of this year we were talking about the Pittsburgh Pirates possibly being in a World Series? I like the Pittsburgh Pirates. I follow them. Obviously, their AAA affiliate is the Indianapolis Indians here in town, so I'm very familiar with the players. Sterling Marlin's actually been on this show before, so very, very familiar with the Pirates. So the Pirates put something good together. Hopefully they can build on that going forward. But Mike Matheny, obviously taking the place of Tony La Russa, the culture that Tony put there for the St. Louis Cardinals, it doesn't matter who they've got. They've proven that they can lose Albert Pujols. They can lose some key players. They can have some injuries. They can have some losses and still get to the World Series. So talk to us about the St. Louis Cardinals, as you know them, how they made this trip to the World Series in 2013.
Well, everybody talks about the Cardinal Way, and if you're a Cardinal fan, you love the Cardinal Way. If you're not a Cardinal fan, you hate the Cardinal Way, and you hate hearing about it. But the Cardinal Way is a fundamental methodology of not just playing baseball, but building a farm system, running a business office, everything and everybody at the St. Louis Cardinals. They are fueled by winning, they're fueled by success, and they're fueled by doing it the right way. If you ever talk to Dan Farrell, who runs their business operations, this is a quality guy, a guy who knows what he's doing. He's very, very competent, but he's also great in the community, and he's wonderful to deal with. And that essence invades the entire operation, and that's what they do. The Cardinals, from a baseball standpoint, they had 15 guys on the LCS roster who are making the minimum. Only 10 were making above like $526,000. And yet, year after year after year, they go to the postseason. I think this is their 10th in the last 14. They've won two World Series in the last eight. This could be their third. It's not a dynasty, but it's close, and it's fueled on playing baseball the right way. And I really enjoyed the LCS because Yasiel Puig is a guy who hasn't embraced playing baseball the right way, and he was exposed in Game 7, and that was a lot of fun to watch because the Cardinals do it the right way. They make mistakes, you know, sure. The pop-up that fell between Wainwright and Yachty, that's a mistake. But over and over again, you know, over time, over a 162-game schedule, they do things the right way. They move runners. They take bases when it's wise. They work deep counts when it's necessary. They're just really good fundamental baseball players. And those guys who come over, like Carlos Beltran coming over to the Cardinals organization, he went from being a guy who really couldn't be counted on to play a full season. He embraced the Cardinal methodology and really wound up having two of his the better seasons in his career. I was brought up a Cubs fan. I grew up on the north side of Chicago, and we're supposed to not like the Cardinals, and Cardinal fans aren't supposed to like the Cubs. But moving to St. Louis, I really developed a profound appreciation, not just for the way the team plays baseball, but for the way the fans comport themselves and the way the Cardinals as a business operate.
Well, absolutely, and I love the Cardinals, and you also are a diehard Cub fan. We won't hold that against you, but you certainly are an admirer of the Cardinals and worked there in the Cardinal market for a while. I want to refer to an article on your website, Kent's Crumbs, talking a little bit about last night's game, and you really did phrase this well. I wish that I had the writing ability that you do to put this into words, because it is exactly true. The national media just, you say ESPN or whoever you want, always clings to the East Coast teams, whether they be the Yankees or the Red Sox or whoever it might be. And so quotes here, the national media is in full hyper mold as the Cardinals were blitzed 8-1 last night in Boston. They are like the Nimrods who read the first chapter to a novel to feel that they know exactly what is going to follow. If this series was Gone with the Wind, Rhett Butler just kissed Scarlett O'Hara. I loved it. Chapter 2 is tonight and will be played out tonight out in Boston. So talk with us about some of the and I should point out that we talked with you earlier on in the week, so this is actually Thursday, so I realize that we know a little bit more than we know now when the show airs on Saturday, but Chapter 2 is being played at the time of this recording, or at least getting ready to play. I don't think, and you also pointed this out, even no matter what happens with this game, fans still won't be able to guess accurately what will happen throughout the rest of the series. So go ahead and what say you on Kent's Crumbs?
I think that the Cardinals are going to be fine. I think the series goes deep. These teams, they both won 97 games, do the little things well. They have a great internal culture. The guys on the Red Sox, the guys on the Cardinals, they all like each other, and that sustains you over a really long season. And you can see that on the faces of a guy like Chris Carpenter, who's still with the team, not actively participating because of the nerve damage. But he's engaged. The guys are all up against the dugout fence throughout all the games. Same thing with the Red Sox. I think it's a great series because it's the two best teams in baseball playing against each other, and they both play really good fundamental baseball, and they're both really fun to watch.
We're talking with Kent Sterling of KentSterling.com and 1070 The Fan, a host, head of the curve with Fox 59, Chris Hagan, every Saturday on 1070 The Fan, which is why we had to record you, because you're actually talking to the same time we are. So I appreciate you taking some time to talk with us. Well, as we very well, those of us that watched that game last night, know that the left-handed wall may not be the only greening monster out there at Fenway Park. Say it ain't so, I'm asking you, say it ain't so, John Lester cheating in game one. He brought out the Vaseline, and not for all the good reasons.
Yeah, I don't think he does it any more than anybody else. You know, everybody's looking for an advantage. He was awful good. His pitches did move like crazy. His cutter was unbelievable. But I don't, you know, it's kind of like the people during the Dodgers series that the Cardinals played when, and I can't remember the name of the base runner, collided with Molina.
He didn't
there
tag
was no me. Tag. Right, exactly. But, you know, that's an out. Everybody knows it's an out. Lester coming out with a foreign substance on his glove, I mean, that's, you know, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying.
Right. Well, that's what they say in racing, and we're finding out that seems to be the truth, too. Apparently, unfortunately, though, cheating might be the way of the game, which I don't necessarily agree with. Last night, or Wednesday night, game one proved to very much to be Wayne wrong. What happened with Wainwright? He just didn't seem to be himself. Maybe it was because it was game one. Maybe it was nerves. But you would think a guy at that level, a leader of that team, could go out there and not be fazed by game one of the World Series.
I think a little of it was that there was a long lapse between starts. I think he had 9 days between starts. And that's a lot of rest for a guy who gets the ball every fifth day. He said his mechanics were screwed up, but he knows how they were screwed up. He knows how to fix it. So I think in game five, he comes back, assuming there is a game five. And I think there will be. He's going to come back and be strong. He's too good a horse. You know, he's not the kind of guy who puts up numbers like that. Regardless of the defensive lapses of Pete Kosma, who frankly the Cardinals need to do something about in the off season. You can't have a shortstop who, you know, he had a bad night with his glove, and you can't have a bad night with your glove if you're going to hit 217. But I think Wainwright's going to be fine. He's a great guy. He's a great community guy in St. Louis. He's got a terrific arm. Frankly, with him, I worry about the number of pitches he threw this year and the number of innings he threw. I don't think that a normal body, especially an arm that's had Tommy John surgery, can withstand that kind of strain season after season after season.
Well, that brings me to a very, very good point. And one of the things that you touched on earlier, the St. Louis Cardinals have a culture of winning. It's the Cardinal way. And what they do is they develop young players. And one of those young players is Waka, 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 and Waka do we trust. That's the new hashtag going around social media. Obviously, those Cardinal fans like myself are very much in tune with that. We love our new guy, our young kid, Waka, Waka, Waka. We don't need a beard to win a baseball game against the Red Sox. How good is this Waka kid, 21 years old, pitching in the World Series? Can you believe it?
He's great. And, you know, 18 other teams passed on him. He was drafted 19th, and it was a compensatory pick for losing Albert Pujols. So Pujols left, but they got that pick, and with that pick they took Waka. And I think that even if you just look at Pujols in 12, 13, and whatever he does down the road compared to what Waka does, I think the Cardinals got the best of that deal, and that's what John Mozeliak, the general manager of the Cardinals, does.
I tell you what, and I don't want to just dominate the Red Sox because we are a national show. I realize we have a lot of Red Sox fans. So let's walk on the to the other side of the field, to the other dugout. Let's walk into the dugout of bearded men. Let's talk about what the Red Sox need to do to beat the Cardinals. Obviously, that's happened before. 45 years ago, more or less, 1968, it happened. Long about this same time, seven games deep, the Cardinals lost. I'm sorry, it was 1967, I'm sorry, that the Red Sox beat the Cardinals. So it has happened, and obviously in recent memory, the Red Sox have beat the Cardinals in the World Series. The Red Sox know how to beat the Cardinals. Mike Matheny is a very calculated manager that they have to play strategy, a really more or less a game of chess. So what does Boston Red Sox need to do to win this World Series? And you know what? As much as I love the Cardinals, I think there's a certain part of the Boston Red Sox that absolutely could come in, not sweep them, but certainly could come in seven games and take advantage of a weak bullpen with the St. Louis Cardinals, if not done right, and win.
Well, I think that the Red Sox kind of showed the blueprint last night. They need to work deep counts, swing only at strikes, make the Cardinal pitchers get them out with strikes, and then the timely hitting to back that up. And when you do that, you're going to win baseball games. And then on the other side, they really need good pitching. And not having Buchholz, I guess it's 50-50 whether he's going to throw game four or throw it all in the series. I think that's a big deal, too. That completely throws the dynamic of Game 4, where the Cardinals have Lance Lynn. If the Red Sox don't have Buchholz, that's a completely different game and will likely have a completely different outcome.
Well, we're talking with Kent Sterling. Kent, I know we're short on time here. I appreciate the time you've taken with us to talk with us today about the World Series and certainly about the St. Louis Rams. But the St. Louis Rams, after the bye week, meet the Indianapolis Colts. This is going to be a very, very difficult match for the St. Louis Rams. But also, the Indianapolis Colts need to enjoy that win and that week off. But at the same time, they do need to prepare for the St. Louis Cardinals. St. Louis Rams. That would be a story on itself. The St. Louis Rams, the Rams and the Colts. What are some of the things you see about that game coming up?
Well, I think that's an almost automatic Colts win. I think that the Rams without Sam Bradford are virtually a Jacksonville Jaguars level franchise. They have some talent defensively, but they have lapses. And I think Andrew Luck's the guy who can take advantage of those lapses. And offensively, they are really more or less inert. And if the Colts defense was stout enough to stop the Broncos and Peyton Manning in large part, I don't think they're going to have any trouble with St. Louis.
Well, Kent,
I love them though. I'm going to be the spotter for the Rams radio network that day with some of my old coworkers. So
well, there you go.
Maybe I'm talking out of school. I love the Rams, but I think the Colts are going to wipe them out.
Well, I think that all the crystals will line up for that. The fortune ball tells us. I don't think that is one that we really need to worry about. But at the same time, stranger things have happened, and certainly upset alerts have happened. But, you know, one of the things that I worry about, and maybe it won't come in too much of effect with this particular game, but as you talked about a few days ago on Breakfast with Kent, you were talking about Reggie Wayne being a huge blow. And you know, talking about Bill Polian and what he would do and maybe pull somebody up from the practice squad. And we know Brian Grinson has been very, very aggressive, probably went out there and played the free agent wire and wheeled and dealed more than any general manager in the NFL. Not that Reggie Wayne is replaceable, but will Grigson go in and look for a new wide receiver since Reggie Wayne is out? Or does the next man up have to be Hayward Bay and T.Y. Hilton have to get up there? And, hey, guess what? We learned from the best, Reggie Wayne, and we're ready for the job, Coach.
Well, I think that we're going to find out this week what Ryan Grigson thinks about T.Y. Hilton and about Darius Hayward Bay. If he doesn't think that highly of him, he's going to go out and trade for a guy like Hakeem Nicks, who's going to be a free agent at the end of the season. The Giants are playing a lost season at this point. They're 1-6. So we're going to find out whether Ryan Grigson thinks those guys can carry the mail. And I think they can. I think T.Y. Hilton, he's a little bit undersized, and that's why he fell to the third round. But overall, I mean, I can't think of many exterior receivers that you'd rather have at his stage of development than T.Y. Hilton. And as far as Darius Hayward Bay, as long as he holds onto the ball, he's a beautiful athlete. He can run. He can move. He runs good routes. And Andrew Luck has a way of inspiring these guys to play their best. And I think these guys are going to step up. And Reggie's still going to be there as the leader. And I think that those guys are going to step up and do the job. And if Grigson thinks that somebody can help, we know he's going to go get them.
Well, we're talking with Kent Sterling. Kent, I appreciate you taking some time with us today. I always like to ask my guests. I always like to ask my guests this, and certainly I know you cover a wide array of topics of sports, much like we do here on The Balance. So, is there anything that we didn't ask you? Anything you'd like to talk about? Anything you'd like to chime in? What's coming up this next week on Breakfast with Kent? And I don't want anybody to turn off my show to go to your show, but what's going on the head of your ahead of the curve with you and Chris Hagan over at 1070 The Fan?
Well, we're going to talk Colts. Obviously, it's the bye week, but we'll still talk Colts. We talked to much like this is recorded. I recorded about 10 minutes with Solomon Hill today at Pacers practice, and so we're going to play that. And Solomon is a great kid. And what Larry Bird's done with the roster of the Indiana Pacers over the last 8 years is really phenomenal. He's gone from it was a band of renegades after the retirement of Reggie Miller, and they had a bunch of you know, not the best citizens, and what he's done is go out and get really, really good guys who get along very well. They understand their role in the community. They know how to play winning basketball. They went out and got a great leader in David West, and they're going to contend for an NBA title. And I think they should be the odds-on favorite in the NBA Eastern Conference. I think it's going to be a phenomenal year for the Pacers. And then with the Hoosiers, it's a complete unknown, isn't it? They lost almost all their offense. They lost 80% of their minutes. And, you know, how much of the load can Noah Vonleh and Yogi Ferrell and Will Sheehy carry? I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens in Bloomington this year.
Well, absolutely. And on the football side, do they get into a bowl game this year?
They've got to win those three games, the three home games that are left against Minnesota, Illinois, and Purdue. If they win those, they go. The other games I don't think are winnable. They play at Wisconsin and at Ohio State, if I'm not mistaken. And those are losses. But the other three, they've got a good chance to win. I think Kevin Wilson's the right guy for that job. He's getting a little bit of heat. Kurt Mallory's getting a little bit of heat. But I think they're about ready to turn the corner. And once they get – if they get to next year with another good recruiting class, I think that they're going to have guys that have been in the pipeline that can absolutely play, and they're going to be a different team.
Absolutely. Well, Kent Sterling, we appreciate you taking some time to be with us. I can talk with you all night long, but I know I catch you a window there. Breakfast with Kent. Now, I tell you what, I like breakfast with Kent. It's quick. It's easy. Good cup of coffee there. You can find that on YouTube, social media. You're all over the place, but where can people find your writings, find Breakfast with Kent, find you on Twitter, stalk you on Facebook, anywhere?
Absolutely, people should friend me on Facebook, and that's how we wish people happy birthday at the end of every Breakfast with Kent, because it's a little folksy, and I miss the folksiness of radio a little bit.
Sure.
So, and I grew up in Chicago with a guy named Gray Rayner, who did a morning show for kids that I thought was just hilarious. So the birthdays are kind of a tip of the hat to Ray Rayner. But on Facebook, search me, Kent Sterling. I accept almost all friends. And, any who are from this, you get kind of the weird solicitations from kind of out of the country. They're looking for money or whatever. I don't accept those, but all others. And at Kent Sterling is the Twitter handle, and Ahead of the Curves on 1070 The Fan every Saturday, usually from 11 to 1, but this week it's from 8 to 10. And then KentSterling.com is kind of a one-stop resource for all of that stuff. All the interviews that we do on Ahead of the Curve, I post on KentSterling.com. And periodically I'm really enjoying the process of creating content rather than managing it. Creating the content's really a lot of fun, and I enjoy it every day.
Oh, absolutely, and I could echo that more. And so, if you're not looking to get money from Kent, but if you're looking to give money to Kent, he'll accept your friendship. But if not, Kent, we appreciate it. You're always welcome here on The Balance. Don't be a stranger.
Thanks. Absolutely. Have a good night.
All righty, you there, sir?
Yeah. That's
all right.
Terrific. Thanks.
I appreciate it, buddy, and we'll get you out, and I'll have Michelle, my producer, send you out an MP3 probably Saturday afternoon.
Excellent. I'll look forward to it.
We'd love to have you on anytime, sir.
Okay, absolutely. Just shoot me a note, and I like doing this kind of stuff. It's fun.
It's a lot of fun. Thanks, Kent.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
That was Kent Sterling. I enjoyed having him on the show with us. So we're going to be taking a momentary break here, and then we're going to be connected with Kevin Lee here in about 30 minutes. We'll probably just be playing a bit of music. So that's just kind of what we're going to be doing here, just playing a bit of music. Again, this is just going to be deleted, and so, I don't know. We're going to connect with Kevin Lee here. And I'm just talking right now just to kind of fill up space. I don't even know why I'm talking. I like to talk to myself. Well, we're going to be connecting with Kevin Lee here in about 25, 27 minutes. And we'll be doing segment number two.
taping Kevin Lee in approximately 17 minutes. Again, this is just a taping segment.
We'll be taping Kevin Lee here in just a moment, in about 17 minutes. This is just a taping segment of The Balance. These interviews will be aired on October the 26th. So, again, this is just a recording session.
We're doing a taping. Kevin Lee will be doing that here in about 8 minutes. dialing in. Okay, we're going to be dialing in Kevin Lee here and do our interview to be aired on the 26th. Hi, is this Kevin?
Yes.
Hi, Kevin. This is Tom Marquis, host of The Balance. How are you doing, sir?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. I appreciate you taking some time for us today and taping this for us. Really, it's going to be pretty cut and dry. We're going to do a recap of the championship last week, talk a little bit about the injuries, Justin Wilson, Dario Franchitti, talk about the Grand Prix of Indianapolis, talk about IndyCar next year, and also I kind of wanted to mention a little bit about that Dan Weldon tribute out in Newcastle on Saturday. Does that work for you?
Yep, sounds good.
All right. I'll just do a countdown and just go right into it.
Okay.
3, 2, 1. Well, welcome back to The Balance, my minions. My name is Tom Marquis, El Presidente, as we do every Saturday morning right here on The Balance. We take some time out to talk about racing and everything that goes fast, and we talk everything from IndyCar to NASCAR, and I'm honored to have with me this morning. I caught up with him earlier on in the week, but I'm honored to have with me one of the what I would consider the foremost experts of IndyCar, Mr. Kevin Lee of NBC Sports, 1070 the Fan. Also, yeah, I'm sure you've seen him on Indiana Pacers, Fox Sports, Indiana, certainly a radio host, sideline reporter. Really, I guess the better question is, Kevin, what is it that you don't do in radio and television?
Well, when you're a freelance broadcaster, you take any job you can get.
I hear you, sir. I appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk with us today, and we're very honored to have you for the first time here on The Balance. And, Kevin, obviously you're right there in the action with everything with IndyCar, and your face is certainly associated with Indy broadcasts on NBC Sports, and they've just did a phenomenal job of coming in and taking over the broadcast of that and allowing fans to really get up and close and personal with IndyCar other than just the Indianapolis 500. And I certainly want to recap the championship last week, that race, Scott Dixon, his championship, but I also want to talk a little bit about Dario Franchitti. How's he doing?
As far as I know, he's doing as well as he could be doing. He's here in Indianapolis, as I understand. He's out of the hospital, was released last week. He's got a long road ahead of him to deal with the back injuries, but from people that I've talked to that have talked to him, he's in great spirits and is anxious to get back into a race car as soon as he can. Certainly, these are serious injuries, but as scary as that was, I think we all feel, it's easy for us to say because we're not dealing with the rehab, but I think everybody who knows Dario feels pretty pleased and fortunate that it is as it is, and he's going to be fine eventually, and he's probably going to be able to answer the bell at the beginning of next season.
Well, horrific wreck that he was involved in a few weeks before the championship, and it was just such a scary wreck. And, you know, at the time of the broadcast and watching it on your broadcast and the various highlights, you could just tell just that there was that moment there of that gasp. That, you know, we remember back, you know, just a few years ago when we lost Dan Weldon out in Las Vegas, a very, very eerie similarity on how the broadcast was handled. You're right there on the front lines with that. Walk us through when that was going on. What was going on in your headset, and what was going on? What were you guys thinking about? What were you talking about?
Well, I think part of it is what did happen with Dan. And, you know, up to that point, when Dan crashed, I'll be honest, I didn't have an immediate concern. Now, I also hadn't seen it. I was working the radio broadcast that day in Vegas, and I didn't have an immediate replay. I knew it was a scary crash in the way it was being described, but we had almost become complacent because these cars are designed so much better. The safer barrier helps with the safety that we had become complacent to the fact that, well, they always get up and they always ultimately walk away and might only have to deal with some minor injuries. So I think now anytime there's a scary-looking crash, it's kind of brought us back to reality that bad things can happen. And so until you hear something definitive and positive, then you just don't know. And I'm looking at it on a small monitor, and I couldn't see what was happening inside the cockpit. As I watched the broadcast back after I got home, you could see that he moved around. He was moving his head, and he flipped up his visor. Had I seen that at the time, I think I would have felt a lot better. But I think our approach is one of being very cautious, trying not to speculate very much and just going with facts rather than what we think might be happening. And luckily, we got some facts pretty quickly from someone that was on the scene in Chip Ganassi that gave us at least a report that his injuries weren't dire. Yeah, they're serious, but, you know, he's awake and he's alert and he's talking. So that's good that we could get something definitive out like that instead of just speculating.
We're talking with Kevin Lee of NBC Sports in IndyCar. Obviously, NBC Sports have did a fantastic job of coming in and formerly, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe they're formerly the Versus Network, but just have really did a great job of coming in and bringing IndyCar to the fans. And we talk a little bit about the injuries in Dan Weldon. We know coming up on the 26th, which is today when this show airs, I know we're taping this earlier on in the week. Newcastle, Indiana is hosting a fundraiser, if you will, in honor of Dan Weldon. And Dan's widow, Susie, will be there, I believe, and also some top drivers. Now, Dario Franchitti was scheduled to be there. Is he going to be there in appearance? We obviously would think that he's not going to race, but is he going to be there for this fundraising race out in Newcastle?
I do not know. I would think not, but you never know. I do know that he wanted to come to the race at Fontana last weekend, but the doctors told him he couldn't do that. So I suppose it's possible, but his brother Marino is going to be racing in his place. And there's a long list. I don't have it in front of me of IndyCar drivers, but it's, you know, it's 10, 12, every team. I think there are 12 or 13 teams, mm-hmm. and every team has an IndyCar driver on their team, and some have two, and they used basically a gray area that it's not a full-time driver. For example, I think Connor Daly, who raced in the Indy 500, is on a team with Alex Tagliani, and there are several Indy Lights drivers, some Pro Mazda drivers. So there's a lot of ringers there, and then there are some corporate types. So you're going to have a lot of different skill levels out on the track at different times. I think this is a two-hour race in the rental carts, the kind of carts that you and I can go out there and race, which I will say are plenty quick enough for most
for
of
me.
Us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, these will go, you know, 50 miles an hour or so down the straightaway, and there aren't too many corners where you can go flat out with that unless you really know what you're doing. So they're going to get up and move a little bit, and it's really just a good casual experience, and it's one thing that IndyCar provides in difference, I think, to some other sports, is that these people are pretty approachable. And if you ever wanted an opportunity to meet them, this is a good chance. They're accessible during a race weekend, but I think we also have to understand that pretty much every minute of their day on a Saturday, Sunday of a race weekend is accounted for. So it's hard for them to stop and talk for a long while. This is going to be a little better chance. And it's, yeah, they want to win, but it's not quite the same thing as their real job. And most of the drivers are also sticking around. I wouldn't say most, but quite a few are also racing in the Robopong race, which is a big national kart race, which is an endurance race. I think it's 200 miles around about a one-mile track, so it'll take about 4 hours. There are two or three drivers per team. They have to do pit stops and things like this. And this is serious stuff. The winning team gets $10,000. So, you know, you see the Joseph Newgardens, and I know Will Power told me he was looking forward to doing it. Ed Carpenter does it every year. There are seven or eight IndyCar drivers and a lot of really top-notch kart drivers that are in this. So both days are a lot of fun, good accessibility. I know on Saturday they've got an autograph session set for, I'm going to say, something like 11:45 on Saturday. I think the race is at about 2:45 on Saturday. And proceeds are going to the Alzheimer's Association. Dan Weldon's mother has been dealing with Alzheimer's for many years. So Dan's brothers, his dad, his wife Susie is going to be there. So many of his friends. I know Scott Dixon is one of those that's driving. So it should be a good time this weekend in Newcastle.
Well, absolutely. And just for our Indianapolis listeners, I know we're a national broadcast, but for Indianapolis listeners, Newcastle's just a short 45-minute drive down 70 East, and you'll get there, and you certainly have time to get there right after this show, because we're airing this interview at 9:30 in the morning. So you have time to get out there. Lionheart, Dan Weldon, we tragically lost him back in 2011 in Vegas, and just really a huge shock to the racing community. So it's a good opportunity for you to bring awareness and to raise money for the Alzheimer's Association, but at the same time to get out there and remember Dan and be a part of that racing. Let me ask you this, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, but why Newcastle?
Well, that's one of the best kart facilities in the country, and it certainly is by far the best outdoor kart facility in the state of Indiana, the closest to Indianapolis. So that's an easy one, and it's a race that Dan drove in, the Robopong race, that he won in 2005, and I know he raced in it several times, was scheduled to race it in 2011, had to cancel because he was going to race in Australia, so he wasn't set to race that at the end of that season. But he loved Newcastle. That's what IndyCar drivers do on their off weekends. My son races karts out there, and we just started doing it a couple of months ago, but every time we've gone out there, we've run into an IndyCar driver. So that's what they do, and karting is how they stay fresh and keep sharp. And this is, I'm told, one of, if not the best facilities in the country.
Well, wow, that's some good information. I did not know that. I knew they had a great kart race out there, and I knew that they did that charity race every year prior to the 500, but I did not realize what a caliber it was, so thanks for sharing that with us. Well, obviously, last weekend, Scott Dixon gets crowned his third championship. It was pretty much the usual suspects as we went into to the chase there, but talk with me about Scott Dixon, how he was able to pull it off. Certainly he was right there neck and neck with Elio, and really up until, you know, when we could figure out who the winner was going to be, we didn't know who was going to be the champion. And it's always good, especially to see a guy like Scott Dixon and Elio in there. Those are the usual suspects. Don't get me wrong, I would love to see Hinch up there sometime, and I would love to see some of the younger drivers have that opportunity. But it's good to see good caliber drivers get the championships. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about the flaws of the chase, and that's certainly not the point of this conversation. But I think IndyCar really did it right this year. I think by far this year, 2013, was probably outside of maybe a few mishaps, one of the best seasons year-long around, and got the championship right this year.
Well, I think what stands out to most of us about the IndyCar season and the championship is that they don't have to have any kind of a chase or a playoff system or reset points or anything like that. And every single year it comes down to the last race. This is 8 years in a row. You know, I'm going to say it's maybe 12 of the last 14, something like that. Since the early 2000s, it's 04 and 05 are the only 2 years where the champion hasn't been decided in the last race, and it's usually not decided until the last lap. And even though this championship was won by 27 points, with 20 laps or so to go, it's still not set. As long as Castroneves was on the lead lap, you knew that Dixon still had to finish the race, because if he finished somewhere in the teens and Castroneves won the race, then Castroneves could still win the championship. And there were points in that race where the points as they ran, when Elio was leading and Dixon was somewhere in the teens, that Elio would have been the champion if they finished where they were at. But Dixon won it because he did what he usually does. He does what he needs to do. Elio had to win the race, and Dixon had to finish worse than sixth. So Scott knew he just needed to stay within reach, be smart. Late in the race, they were having some overheating problems, as a lot of teams were, and they were worried about losing an engine. There was a lot of debris that was getting in the radiator inlets, so they were being really cautious, taking extra pit stops, not worried about, especially since there were so many cars that were off the lead lap, you could pit as many times as you want and still be 6th, 7th, 8th, whatever it was at the time. So they just did simply what they needed to do, weren't too concerned about winning the race. Castroneves had to win, and eventually he took some contact and had to change a wing, and that put him a lap down and ended any chance that he had. But it was a fantastic championship, and I think a real story is that Scott Dixon had an awful start to the season. The Hondas clearly did not have the power that the Chevys did at the beginning of the season. They were getting a little better horsepower, but they they weren't that competitive in Indianapolis. But starting at Pocono, they found something, and I think it was at a test at Sebring, and it applied a little bit to Pocono, then it certainly applied to the road and street courses, and Dixon won three in a row. He was able to deal with awful luck for a couple of straight races. And then finally, Castroneves had bad luck. He had had a charm season, no DNFs, had run every lap until he lost a gearbox in both races at Houston. So this is not a case where Elio choked. He led most of the year. It was just mechanical issues that erased the big lead he had going into the final three races, and he just about did everything he could at Fontana. But again, the broken wing ended any chance he had of winning the race. So the Tripp Championship, they had 10 different winners this year. They've got parity. We had four first-time winners. Yes, it's still a lot about Penske and Ganassi and Andretti to some extent, but you saw A.J. Foyt win a race this year. You saw Dale Coyne win a race again this year. You saw what the people refer to, I think unfairly, as the B team from Ganassi with Charlie Kimball win a race. But you saw a guy that people didn't think could win a race at this point. So I think people like that they go into these races, especially the non-ovals, knowing that there's a list of about 15 different drivers that can win.
Well, absolutely, and we had an opportunity to see James Hinchcliffe win, certainly one of my personal favorites, and I always enjoy talking to him out there at the track when they're here in town with the Indy 500 and different races that I have an opportunity to go to, and I love talking with James. He's very, very aggressive, very, very good racer. Now, he moves over next year. He moves over to Andretti Motorsports next season. What kind of effect will that have on him and the success he's been able to lay down this year in 2013?
Well, I think his decision, a lot of it was based on stability. He's going to have a new sponsor next season. GoDaddy is exiting IndyCar as a primary sponsor, but he's going to stay with Andretti where he's been the last couple of years, and that's the idea behind that. He had, I think, some other offers and opportunities out there, but you know with Andretti what you have and what he has, and they've got a good thing going with Ryan Hunter-Reay, and Marco Andretti is back. The fourth and potentially fifth cars with Andretti are a little bit uncertain right now. We're pretty certain Carlos Munoz, who was the rookie who finished second in the Indy 500 this year, is going to move up from Indy Lights into an Andretti car. But Hinchcliffe is going to be a factor again, and he's great for IndyCar. He's from Toronto. Canada is a great market for IndyCar. I think Americans embrace Canadian drivers just as well, so it's almost as if you get two nationalities covered there. And he lives part-time in Indianapolis, and he's just great at marketing himself, his sponsors in the series. So while we're not supposed to root for people, I think a lot of people within the series are happy that Hinchcliffe does well.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that in a lot of ways he's become the new face of IndyCar, and that's exciting to see the new young drivers up and coming. And, you know, one of the other big news that as far as switches going around, we look at Ganassi switches to Chevy after years of being with Honda. First of all, why that switch? And good thing, bad thing?
You know, we never got any definitive answer, and that's not surprising. Most companies keep these types of things somewhat under wraps. It could be because he's also a Chevy team on the NASCAR side, so he wants to simplify things a little bit. It could be because some business aspects worked out better to be aligned with Chevy. And it might be, and this probably makes the most sense, that he just thought he had the best chance to win the Indianapolis 500 being a Chevy team. And Chip was pretty outspoken of his unhappiness with Honda early in the season where they were clearly down on horsepower to Chevy, and the decision might have been made at that point. Second half of the season, obviously Honda really got their act together. And I was told by Honda drivers this weekend at the big oval at Fontana that they were still down on power, but they felt like they had a chance to be competitive because of potential the ability just to run the 500 miles, and they might get better fuel mileage and so forth. And next year there's some changes as far as the specs of engines that might equalize things just a little bit. So we'll see what happens there. But it probably just came down that Chip decided, all right, I think Chevy's got a better program right now, so we're going to try to hook up with them.
Well, and absolutely. We're talking with Kevin Lee of NBC Sports, Pit Reporter, and just really a big part of the broadcast with NBC Sports and IndyCar. Well, I tell you what, it's going to be a great year for 2014. And we talk about the Indianapolis 500, brand new look, brand new face. We've got, of course, the Indianapolis 500 is the same as always, but we also have the Grand Prix of Indianapolis, and that. And we've talked about this many times on this show, and we've talked about it with different people. I think a lot of fans like the idea that they can go see IndyCar on a road course. Are you a road course IndyCar fan? Great, we got something for you. Oval, you got your diehard oval fans like, oh, we don't like that road course. Then you got the diehard road course IndyCar fans that say, hey, we love that. Although they're not going to be racing through the streets of Indianapolis, but they will be on the road course out there at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Grand Prix of Indianapolis. We really don't have anything to judge it by, but looking at it, this is all things positive for Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the sport, and the Indianapolis 500.
I think IndyCar is in a situation where they need to be bold, and they need to be willing to take some chances, and clearly running another race with IndyCars at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway doesn't sit well with everyone. There are some traditionalists that are very much against it. I think the argument to that would be that's already by the wayside. Once they had a NASCAR race there, a Formula One race, a MotoGP race with motorcycles, there's a sports car race now. You know, we've moved past that, so let's just do the best thing that they can do for the business. And the other concern was, well, this might take away from the 500 or hurt the 500. And I'm sorry, I can't buy that one at all. I just don't see anyone saying, I'm going to this road course race and not going to the 500. If you're going to pick one, you're going to the Indianapolis 500. So this is going to be either people deciding they're going to both, or really that's probably it. Or maybe they have some sort of conflict on race day with the 500, and this is the only time that they can come. It's not going to be 250,000 people. We understand that. But if you look at the kind of crowds they get at most other places, I think it's going to be similar. They've said they're hoping for around 40,000. I think that's more the number looking for in future years. I'll be surprised if it's not 50 or 60. I think it could be as many as 80 this first year because I think people are going to be interested in it. There have been concerns about whether this road course is raceable or not. And some of the drivers have said it's not a good road course. But they're going to make a few changes. And even if they don't, we've heard that going to places like Barber Motorsports Park. Well, you can't pass there. Mid-Ohio, Sonoma. They've had good racing there with this new Dallara car that was introduced last year. So I'll be surprised if it's not a good race. The car is more durable. They can bang a little bit. The Grand Am races have been good there. But the main thing that this does, well, there are several. One is it brings revenue. That's extra money. Normally on that opening weekend, they'll draw 5,000 people to come to Indy 500 practice. Now maybe you draw between the 3 days. Maybe you draw somewhere between 60 to 100,000 people. So that's extra cash. They can get a title sponsor for this race, which could be over $1 million. That's cash for IndyCar that lets them do other things. And I think the way I've described it is it announces your presence with authority. It opens up the month of May with something that might get you a little bit more on the map. I live here in Indianapolis, and I think people nationally think that, well, everyone knows what's going on at the track in May, but they don't. Even in Indianapolis, they really pay attention. Once we get to that weekend, I think you'd like to let people know that the track is open, and I think you've got a better chance doing that if you have a race that's going to be on national television. The media is going to get behind this. Everybody's going to be here. Yes, it's an extra IndyCar race that I think will get a better rating than any of the other races except for the 500, but I think it's going to be a big kickstart for the Indy 500. It's a three-hour commercial on ABC for the 500, so I just can't find enough negatives to say that they shouldn't be doing this. I think this is something that they should be doing, utilizing their best asset, which is the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Well, absolutely, and I couldn't have worded it better myself. That is exactly what that is. And what a great move it was. I applaud them. I think it's a great thing for the sports. I think it's a great thing for fans. And talk about, one of the things that I've heard fans talk about is on the road course, it's hard to see. You can only see parts of it. Well, they're used to watching it in an oval, but I do know that they're doing some work out there. They're increasing some mound areas, and they're trying to move around some spectator areas. So maybe some of those problems will be changed. Obviously, it's going to be happening over the weekend of the 14th, and as you said, it's a big lead-in to the Indianapolis 500, which – I think, you know, obviously it's going to draw a lot of local people, but certainly within a 5 to 6 hour drive, I think we're going to get a lot of people. And I totally agree with that number of 80,000 there on the very first race. I mean, look at how big Brickyard was on the very first race that was. So an exciting time it is for the Indianapolis Grand Prix as we get ready for that. Now, always what we try to do here, Kevin, is and I know we've got these questions a little bit early, but through our social media stuff, we get different questions throughout the week, and I kind of put them aside, and we talk about them during the show. So I'm just going to – some of these we've already talked about, but there are a couple questions here that have been tweeted to us. Was that the first win for Will Power of the season?
No. He won, I think, 3 races this year.
Okay, so he won 3 races, and what about the comment?
I know he won the second race at Houston, and he won at Sonoma as well. So what was a down year for Will really wasn't that bad. He won 3 races and finished 4th in the championship, and I spent some time with him on Sunday night after the banquet, and he was pretty excited about the performance, and he was really proud of the fact that he finished every oval this year. He thinks he's taken a major step forward, and I really think he's going to be a big-time contender for the championship again next year.
And I think you answered the next question there, because the next question was, has Will Power shut up his naysayers who said he cannot win on an oval?
I would say yes. It's the second time he's won, although there was a little asterisk the first time because it was the doubleheader race at Texas where it was about half-distant races, slightly more than half-distance, and where they inverted the field. Frank Heedy started way at the back in that race. That was in 2011, I think. But I know he felt really good. I think he felt like he got the monkey off his back. And I said, well, you know, now can you do it when you're in the middle of a championship chase? And he said, yep, that's the next one. But I just think he's got a little better perspective on things and is going to put a little less pressure on himself. So I think he'll perform well on the ovals moving forward.
And one more question from our Twitter world. Has TK been picked up by a team? If not, will he be? And is there any truth to the rumor he'll be going to NASCAR as opposed to IndyCar?
No, he will not be going to NASCAR. He has signed with Ganassi to drive a car with that program, with NTT Data is the sponsor. It's the sponsor that Ryan Briscoe had this year for the Indy 500 in a Ganassi car, so it's not one of the target cars, but it'll be closely associated with Dixon and Frank Heedy, and he'll work out of it. Although that's not totally decided. They may move them all in the same building, but essentially it's a 4-car team with Charlie Kimball being the 4th. But he's got a solid ride. He's very excited about that. Dario Frank Heedy is one of Tony Kanaan's closest friends. They had a great relationship as teammates back with Andretti Green Racing, back when Kanaan won the championship in 04. And then Dario won it in 2007. So I think that this is going to be a pretty formidable team moving forward.
And we've also got another last question here. And what I want to ask you about is the developmental league with IndyCar. I think IndyCar's did a great job of developing young drivers. And we look at where Hinchcliffe has came from and where Pippa Banz came from and others have came out of the Indy Lights series. And now we look at the new Mazda Road to Indy. Any drivers you're looking at in either the Indy Lights Series or the Mazda Road to Indy as we look into 2014 season that really can make their break and to be look for them to be standout drivers in 2014?
Well, I think Sage Karam is the only current Indy Lights driver that has a chance for 2014. He gets some extra money towards his funding. It's up to $1 million as the scholarship money, essentially, as the Indy Lights champion. He, I'm told, is really talented, really bold, aggressive, brave. He grew up across the street from Marco Andretti in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. He started driving in the Road to Indy Ladder Series when he was 15 years old. and what I think is going to stand out next year, because I think he'll at least be in the Indy 500, is that he could drive in the Indy 500 and then graduate from high school the next week. Or maybe it's the week before, but whatever. He is a senior in high school this year, so he will be just finishing up his senior year when he's competing in the Indy 500. And he might do the full season. I think that's to be determined what kind of opportunities he has, because it obviously takes more than the $1 million scholarship. It takes, depending on what team you're with, anywhere between $4 to $7 million to be able to fully fund an IndyCar program. So that's just getting started. But he's got some good backers behind him, so I think we'll see him at least part-time. I think Zach Veach, who is one of the Andretti drivers, is a young kid from Ohio who looks like he's 12 but is also 18. He was in his first year of Indy Lights. I think that people think pretty highly of him. He's marketed himself really well. He's at least a year away. I think you'll see him eventually. And the one down the road to watch out for is Matthew Brabham. He finished the Pro Mazda season this year, which would be, if you know baseball, like AA compared to AAA, which is Indy Lights, one step away from the major leagues. But Pro Mazda is the step before Indy Lights, and he won something like 13 of 17 races this year. And you know he's got the pedigree. His father is Jeff Brabham, former IndyCar driver, former NASCAR driver, sports car champion. And his grandfather is a two-time F1 world champion, Sir Jack Brabham, who drove in the Indy 500. So Matthew Brabham, from all accounts, has it, and he's been dominant so far. So he'll be in Indy Lights next year driving for Andretti, and he's only 18 years old, so we'll maybe 19. But we'll see him in IndyCar in a couple of years.
Amazing to me to see these young kids. Some of these kids don't even have a driver's license yet, and yet they're able to drive cars at 200 miles an hour. Completely amazing. We've been talking with Kevin Lee. Kevin, I appreciate you taking some time with us. Part of the NBC Sports Network, and I know they did a lot with IndyCar, and they really picked up a lot with Formula One. Now, we know that Formula One, I believe, came to Austin this past year. Is there any Formula One scheduled for the States other than one race? Are you going to be working any of those Formula One races?
No, I will not be. They use the same crew for each one. This year they have Austin coming up. I don't have the schedule in front of me, but that's in November, I believe. I think there are maybe four races left. Next year they may go to New Jersey. That's still to be determined. It's on the proposed tentative schedule, but the check still has to be formally written to Bernie Ecclestone before that gets down. So we're hoping for a couple of Formula One races next year. We've been excited at NBC and the NBC Sports Network that we're basically the home of open wheel racing with Formula One and IndyCar.
Absolutely.
And at some point soon, we'll be really one of the main homes to motorsports. Starting in 2015, NBC and NBC Sports Network will have the second half to the NASCAR, Sprint Cup, and Nationwide season. So pretty much any form of motorsport you want to find is mostly going to be on NBCSN. Fox is still going to have the first half of the NASCAR schedule. ABC still has five or six IndyCar races, but if you're uncertain, start looking for NBCSN and NBC. And there are a few other forms of motorsport that you'll find on the network as well.
Well, I tell you what, Kevin, it's been a real honor to have you on and take some time out of your busy schedule. I always ask people this: is there anything that we didn't cover, anything you'd like to talk with us about that we didn't mention tonight?
No, it was a fun season. Looking forward to a little bit of a break, and we'll do it again starting the end of March next year.
Kevin, we really appreciate it. Where can people find your work and your masterpieces and follow you or stalk you on social media?
I guess on Twitter at KevinLee23. You can follow me for I do Indiana Pacers home games on radio and a little bit on TV, and this year I'm going to start working some college basketball games for the Big Ten Network starting in January. So
well,
if there's a game or a race, I'm always looking for work. That's how it goes.
Absolutely, and you do a fantastic job. I mean, you really are the model of the guy that can do it all. So one of these days, we got money on it here. We're going to laugh when we see you on TV at an IndyCar race talking about the Pacers. So we'll see. We'll
I've done that before. I've put that in. I mentioned that when I talked to Ed Carpenter. Ed sits next to me at Pacers games. We slide that in.
He's a huge Pacer fan. All right, Kevin, we appreciate you taking some time with us today. You're always welcome here, and we look forward to watching you in the 2014 season.
All right, thank you so much.
All right. OK, Okay, are you there, Kevin?
Yep.
I appreciate it, buddy. It was a real
honor to
have you on. Have a good evening.
No, my pleasure. Okay,
I'll have Michelle shoot you over an MP3 probably Saturday or so.
Okay.
Okay? All right.
Very good.
Hey,
have a good night.
You too, buddy.
Okay,
see
bye.
Ya. All right, that concludes. We're going to go ahead and end the episode now. We recorded Kent Sterling and Kevin Lee to be aired on October the 26th.